Well, just say it's the beginning, it's the beginning of tape number four, the continuation.
This is the beginning of tape number four, continuation of the afternoon conference, September 9, 1959. The President, Mr. Hillman, Mr. Noyes.
Now, Mr. President.
I think maybe we ought to go back to that question we had last, that we may have missed the President's answer to the tail end there.
Well, the President was just commenting that the overall purpose of his program was to enable people to help themselves, and by doing so, they can help achieve a higher standard of living, and he was hoping that they would achieve a standard of living comparable to our own.
That's correct, and that was one of the things that caused the start point four, the so-called point four, which was to help people help themselves without too much monetary help, but to instruct them on how to use the opportunities which they had. And by getting a small start with this so-called point four program, it was hoped that eventually we'd have education enough around the world so that people would be willing to develop the resources which are available all around the world in such a way that not only would it help their own standard of living, but it'd make it much easier for all the rest of the world to get along together.
Now, it sounds altogether reasonable and practical, Mr. President, but how did this idea come to you? Because this would appear to be the first time in history that a major power undertook such an ambitious program.
Well, it's the first time that a major power ever helped the rehabilitation of the defeated governments in a war. And in doing that, they were doing the thing that would help the people who were being injured. Now, you take Genghis Khan and Tamerlane and all the great emperors of times past, eliminated the people that they conquered and used the land from which they were eliminated to help their own people. That's what the Romans used to do. They'd settle their legions in places and start them up and do away with the population. Well, that's not what should be done. The population that's already there ought to be helped to improve its own situation. And if that's done, that will contribute to world peace more than any other one thing that can be done. Most wars are started for economical purposes. Some great conqueror wants to increase the power that he has by getting control of lands which he thinks are fertile, and that's what's been done all through the history of the world. And I had come to the conclusion that the best way to prevent a thing of that kind from taking place was to have the people on the land that's fertile, if it had the necessary resources to make it produce, go ahead and then learn how to make it produce, and then in the long run they'd understand what the situation is in those countries that have been developed in that way. That's the United States and Canada and part of the African continent and parts of South America. And in the long run, we'd get people to understand that they can get along together if they have the necessary goods and exchanges to keep the people satisfied on both sides of the line.
Now, in a way, that was basic American thinking, wasn't it, Mr. President? Something that you had also seen and read in American history as a result of the Civil War and the aftermath when there was a...
Yes, that's right. Only we didn't follow through on the basis on which I had in view. We murdered as many Indians as we could and took the land away from them. But I thought they could have been maintained on their lands and improved in their position and would eventually have become exceedingly friendly to us, and they have the same sort of brains and set up that we do, and they're brave people. And that could be done, I figured, all around the world. We learned by doing what we ought not to do after the Civil War that you talk about.
Now, the example set by you as spokesman for the West apparently was lost on some of the communist sympathizers or the borderline nations, or unpermitted nations, who were watching this very enormous thing happening. Here you were giving up dedicating our might and our riches to rebuild nations, and especially the conquered nations. And here was Russia on the other side, one of the conquerors held by us, who was exploiting her neighbors and apparently making those neighbors like her, or at least not resent her to the point where it made for any help for us.
I don't think any of them ever liked her. You know what they were doing? You see, Lenin and his cohorts was trying to make the Marxist program appear as if it would work. Well, the Marxist program was out of date, and they couldn't do anything, but instead of taking the countries that are most advanced, which Marx had an idea that the proletariat could take over, they took a country that was as low in the economic scale and as low in liberty and freedom as is possible for an outfit to get, and organized a totalitarian state under the firm force of using concentration camps and murder to get done what they wanted. And that's what they've done in China, and that's what they want to do all around the world. It's not the economic situation that Marx anticipated at all. It's a situation which Lenin worked out himself. This is Leninism, not Marxism at all. And they're both isms as far as that's concerned. And I seem to me that the proper thing to do was to try to get these nations who had suffered from the war rehabilitated and to understand that their proper development would meet the so-called communist proposition head on. There is no communism in the world. The only communism there ever was set out in the Acts of the Apostles. And that's dead. This so-called communism we have now is nothing in the world but a totalitarian state, and there's no difference in dictatorships whether you call it communism or something else.
But here we have the example of you offering under the Marshall Plan to help rehabilitate Czechoslovakia, which was a free nation patterned after us and an industrial nation.
Well, they murdered the president of Czechoslovakia, threw him out the window, and made out like he committed suicide, which he didn't. And that gave them the same opportunity to take over as they did in Romania and Bulgaria and Poland and in Hungary by force, where they murdered the people who understand what freedom means and what we were trying to do. Every one of those countries should have been free. It was agreed by the Russians that they should have free elections and set up their own government, and they'd have set up free governments if they'd had an opportunity, but they didn't.
Well, this is a pretty well-advanced democracy that was subjugated and a self-sustaining democracy in the case of Czechoslovakia. How do you account for their inability to throw it off or to indicate that they would like to throw it off?
Well, let's see, how can 100,000 people operate under in the opposition to 100 million? That's about the proportion. The Russians have 200 million. I expect Czechoslovakia has 3, 4, 5 million. And that's what the trouble was. It's a matter of force, a matter of power. And that's what I've always contended. But when Mom and Papa got to crying and we had to discharge all our military people under a basis that was not for the welfare of the world, we had to accept it. There wasn't anything we could do. But Czechoslovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, and Greece we did save, and Poland could have been saved in the same way if we'd have had the power and the ability to make the Russians stay inside their own borders. And that didn't happen.
Well, Mr. President, what you're suggesting is there that at a critical moment in history, we should not have disbanded, because then we could really have talked more firmly to the Russians about the satellite states.
Isn't any question about that, and that's what we should have done.
Now, we are at this point where we're talking about these nations that have come under the domination of these despots and exploiters.
And you have a very interesting reflection there that with the disbandment of our forces, with the weakening of our power, we certainly were not in any position to do very much about keeping Poland and those other countries free.
No, that's true. one of the things that caused a serious, most serious difficulty was the fact that agreements starting at Quebec and Casablanca and Cairo and Tehran and Yalta, in order to be sure that the Russians would stay put, was on a division of Germany in such a way that the Russians would have a slice and the French a slice and the Americans a slice and the British a slice. And the contemplation of the breaking up of the balance of power in Europe, I don't think was seriously considered without any reflection on anybody. I afterwards talked to Winston Churchill, who had been in this thing ever since the First World War, when he was in charge of the Navy that made the failure at Gallipoli. Mm-hmm. And he wanted me, after all these agreements had been made, to let the Americans hold the line 170 miles east of where they were. They were in Prague and in the outskirts of Berlin. And the agreement had been made at these other places, particularly at Yalta, to set it up in a certain way. Well, I inherited those agreements and I carried them out. If I had been in touch with the whole situation at that time, I don't think I'd have withdrawn the American army from the eastern boundary of Germany, and then we wouldn't have had any serious trouble. But I labored under the feeling, as did a great many other people, that the Russians would keep their agreements. If they had, they wouldn't have been in trouble. They didn't. And so we find ourselves in a Cold War as a result of that. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's just like talking about winning the football game on Monday after it's been lost on Saturday. And the thing we've got to do now is to meet this situation head on as best we can. And what I'm arguing for now is strength enough to meet that situation with an outfit that has no sense of decency or honor. And in order to make them behave, you've got to have more strength than they have. We have it now, if we can just keep it up.
Now, did the possession of ballistics and the nuclear equipment that the Russians now have alter your position on how to deal with them?
No. The only way in the world that you can deal with them is to be in a position, and we are in that position, to be stronger than they are. And we are. In the question about it, unless we just sit back and on a basis of peace at any price, as Nehru has done in India, and you can see what it's cost him. They have no idea of decency or the welfare of the people as a whole. That totalitarian dictatorship is one of the worst the world has ever seen. Now, Rome, at the height of its power with all the great emperors, was never as mean to the people under them as the Russians are to those that they control now. That's Hungary and Romania and Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia and Poland.
Well, that's not a peculiar characteristic of the Russians. They're not barbarians in that sense. Why do they have to impose this kind of sadistic control?
I think they're the worst barbarians the world's ever produced. They have a cross of the Tartar in them. They haven't changed a bit. Just same as Genghis Khan. Only they're not as smart as he was.
What would have happened if you had had your way in keeping the country mobilized immediately after the war?
Well, we'd have been in a position to meet this situation, which I can give an illustration of it. Tito sent me word that he was going to march into Trieste before we had finally decided how the division was going to be made between Yugoslavia and Italy. And I called in the chiefs of staff. General Eisenhower was then commander of the European situation, and I talked with the chief of naval operations, the Air Force chief, and the chief of the military affairs, and asked them how long it would take to move three divisions to the Brenner Pass, and they told me. And it was a very short time, and I asked King, who was the chief of naval operations, how quickly he could get the Mediterranean fleet into the Adriatic Sea, and he told me. And I sent Tito word that we were moving the Mediterranean fleet into the Adriatic Sea, and we'd move three divisions down to the border of Italy at the end of the Brenner Pass, and for him to come on. He didn't. That shows what can be done if you have the ability to do it. But after that, we didn't have the means with which to do things of that sort.
Well, now, supposing
you brought all the divisions home.
All right. Now, supposing you had a lot of divisions, you could not have matched the total number of Russian divisions.
I know, but it doesn't take but one American division. At that time, it wouldn't have taken but one American division to wipe out three Russian divisions because they had no transportation except what we'd given them. They transported their men where what's the old man's name? This was the command of the Russian army. They just fired him the other day. They Zhukov, in the movement of his army, used horses and wagons and people on foot to pull his equipment. Well, we wouldn't have had any trouble holding them off because our divisions were equipped, and we could have held the line anywhere we chose to hold it, making a difference how many people they had. We had the wherewith, the guns and the ability and the young men who were willing to hold the situation and transport that would have taken care of the situation. The Russians didn't have it. We just let them into Germany because that is an agreement that had been made previous to that time. There wasn't anything I could do about it unless I wanted to break the agreement. So now I always had a notion that when an agreement's made, it ought to be kept. And that I also felt that the Russians would be honorable in their settlement. After the Potsdam Conference, which was to implement what had been done before, it was implemented. They broke every one of those agreements.
Now, you say Churchill was the first one to sound the warning that the Russians were not going to keep their agreements.
That's right. He was sure that they would not keep their agreements and that we ought to hold the line. Well, I couldn't do that by myself.
Yet he was party to all of those agreements.
He was party to all those agreements. He was there when they were made, every one of them.
Did he tell you what had caused him to change his mind?
His experience in the Black Sea Straits in the First World War, I think, is the cause of it.
And yet, in spite of that, he proceeded to make agreements with them that he expected them to keep, or?
Well, of course he did. We all expect them to keep them. And you can, as I say, it's a Monday morning quarterback thing. We can see what might have been done. And you know, the Whittier says the saddest of all sad words. Or it might have been.
Might have been. Now,
but of course, what is important, Mr. President, is the fact that we did automatically almost lose our great military strength by this pullback of our troops.
You know, one of the reasons for the pullback of those troops was the idea that it would take 1.5 million men to make Japan stop. And those, a great many of those troops were being moved across the country into the Pacific for the purpose of an invasion in Japan. Well, when we dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that stopped the Japanese war. And it stopped the Japanese war with a great many of our divisions in the country. And some of the men who had been in long-time service in the Pacific were very much put out. Because these boys that hadn't seen much service were discharged first because they were here. That was one of the reasons it brought the thing about. Of course, we didn't know that the Japanese were going to surrender. All my military advisory, my advisor said it would take a year and a half to make Japan surrender. But when they found out what a destructive weapon we had, why, they surrendered right away. And it saved a lot of lives doing that, but that's what took a great many of our divisions out of Europe on the way to the Pacific, and they stopped in the middle of the country.
All right. Now, along that same line, having taken care of the Japanese problem, you still had the Russian problem on your hands, and Russia was beginning to show more and more of its belligerency as we had exhibited the atomic bomb possession. Now, you had a monopoly of the atomic bomb at that time. Could you have used the persuasive power of that bomb to make Russia roll back to her frontiers?
I think so. If we had had the necessary soldiers and sailors to back it up. But a great many of them had been discharged, so there you are, we didn't have them.
Well, had you wanted to have some kind of leverage at that time in order to compel the Russians to come to terms?
Well, at that time we didn't know that they'd have to be compelled. We thought they were going to keep their agreements. I thought so for a year. After this,
a year from when?
A year after Potsdam. A year from Potsdam. It was 1946 before we were fully assured that they were not going to keep their agreements when they started the propaganda against us, and we'd furnished him the equipment which got him out of Stalingrad. And then they made a statement publicly. Stalin made a speech to the conference of the Soviet republics in which he said they had done it all themselves and that the Americans were not their friends and never would be. And then we began to wake up to the fact that he didn't intend to keep his agreements. And he didn't.
And you found yourself helpless to do anything about it at that time.
Wasn't anything to do about it at that time because it was too late. We'd demobilized.
Anyway, you threw in your lot with the United Nations at that time, and you were hoping that the United Nations would be a platform from which some of these things could be resolved?
That's right. And Stalin was very friendly to the United Nations, and when I talked to him over the telephone through Harry Hopkins while he was in the Kremlin, he said, go ahead, we'll back it up. But he didn't mean it.
Did you talk through the benefit of an interpreter?
I talked to Harry Hopkins, and he talked to Stalin through an interpreter, and then Stalin talked to Harry Hopkins through an interpreter, and he talked back to me.
Stalin was present during your talk with Harry Hopkins?
Oh, yes. Harry Hopkins was with Stalin, and I talked to him.
Now, what was the subject you were discussing with him?
The endorsement of the Russians for the United Nations. That's when I told Molotov for to get off when he came by to see me. He was the foreign minister of Russia. And I just told him straight out that this was not a one-way street. If they wanted to do the right thing, we wouldn't have any trouble with us. If they didn't, we'd take another tack. And that's when he said he'd never been talked to like that before. Well, I says, you'll be talked like that, too, like that, unless you keep your agreements.
So this was while the United Nations was being organized.
That's right. When Molotov was on the way to San Francisco for the organization, the United Nations.
And there was some doubt as to whether Russia
that's
would
right.
join the United Nations.
After my conversation with Molotov, I sent Harry Hopkins to Russia. And while he was with Stalin, I talked to him over the telephone and told him that I wanted to get this thing set up, and I wanted Stalin to go along and get it done. And Hopkins told him that, and he said, all right, I'll go along. What else could you ask?
And Stalin did not get on the phone to talk to
him.
Oh,
no, he couldn't. It was English and Russian, and I talked to Hopkins, and he talked to Stalin. Stalin talked to Hopkins, and Hopkins talked to me.
Then your feeling is that having gone through this, we have no prospect about liberation of any of those so-called satellites until another day. Now, what
not
does
unless
that
we
mean?
Want to send 2 million men over there and take them away from them, we can't do that.
That would be a forced rollback.
That's right.
Failing in that, how do you see those people getting out from under the yoke?
Well, they've gotten out from under yokes before. Poland, if I remember correctly, was divided into three countries at one time and was set up again after the First World War with Paderewski as Prime Minister. And the same thing was true of Czechoslovakia. Part of their troops, you remember, marched all the way across Siberia in the First World War, and we brought them home. And the same situation has developed time and again in the history of the world back. Sweden once controlled Poland, if you remember. Sure. Charles XII fought the Battle of Borodino. Had to back up.
Then you are hoping that, or expecting, that these people will live up to the historic precedent of coming into their own someday.
That's
and
correct.
Getting out from under.
They haven't changed a bit. They're still the same people. They still believe in freedom. That's true in Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Poland and all those countries, including Romania, where I'm told they speak almost original Latin language.
Yes. Well, at any rate, then, history must now go through this long waiting period to adjust.
I'm sorry that's the case, but I think the more education the Russians get, the more they find out how the rest of the world lives, it's going to make it much harder on the dictatorship than it is now. And I never have thought the Chinese, in their long background from Confucius to date, would be satisfied with the sort of dictatorship that they have now.
Do you see any conflict as between Russia and China in this?
I think the Russians are very much afraid of China. I think they've built a Frankenstein in their backyard. That's what they call Siberia. I'm not saying that it is a backyard because I think it's a great country and could be developed just like our West was. But they're very much alarmed at what they have contend with on their eastern border, let's put it that way.
Then you, your suggestion for our own position is that we do what for the time being?
Well, the best thing that we can do is to keep up our strength in a way that we can meet any sort of an attack anywhere around the world that affects us as a nation, and try our best to get the educational program into these countries that have been used to freedom in such a way that they'll awaken again, and then when they get ready, maybe we'll be in a frame of mind to help them win their freedom. I think that's about the only thing we can do.
Now, what happens while we get strong? What happens to our enormous foreign aid program? Are you still for its continuity?
I think we've got to continue the foreign aid program as far as it's necessary. Of course, there's not as much necessity for tremendous appropriations for that purpose now as there were when we first started. And after we've got them all, most of them, in a position where they're economically sound on this side of the Iron Curtain, they're in a position to support themselves. And we don't want to just keep wasting our money by sending it over there when it's not needed. And I don't think that it's very long before they'll be able to support themselves. They used to support us, didn't you know that? Nearly all the development of the West came from Great Britain and Germany. Funds that they furnished us to develop that part of the country. And then I think the tremendous amount of the European loans was balanced after the First World War, when they used everything they had as a backlog to get arms to carry on the First World War before we got into it. And of course it was finished off in the Second World War, and now we've got that same situation reversed. We've done the same thing over there, and they still owe us the money, and sometime they'll pay it, maybe. I hope not for a war in this part of the world.
Well, could I then go to this subject? With the world expanding population-wise and the need to keep going industrially, the question arises, as it does in this country, what do you do about getting increased amounts of money which you need to build up industry, to build up housing, to build up an expanding economy?
Well, we have resources, untold resources that have not been developed. You know, what saved the country after the war between the states was the discovery of gold in California, Nevada, and Colorado. And we've got this thing that makes bombs discovered in the same places. And we've got a very rich neighbor on the north whose money now is worth 105 as far as Osh is concerned, which makes some people stand back on their heels when they find out about it. And we've got a very rich country on the south of us. This economy has been stabilized. And with all these things in view, I don't think there's any reason in the world for us to worry about the development of our own country, because as these other countries develop, as I tried to say in the first place, it helps develop our own country, and that's what makes peace in the world, where there's plenty of trade, plenty of resources in each, on each side, where there's an equal exchange of the things that we need that they have and the things that we have that they need. I don't think there'll be any difficulty about that.
Well, then you think our first job is to bring up the level of economies of our neighbors and friends to ours in order to create a level position?
Yes, just like it was between the states when they organized the government of the United States and took down the barriers between the colonies. Everybody thought that the colonies would go to pot, but they didn't. They're all richer than they ever hoped to be under the circumstances. And I think that if we can get the United Nations organization in such shape that it can prevent the grabbers from trying to take over the nations that are well fixed, that in the long run we'll have the same thing around the world. Now, how long it'll last, I don't know. It may be that the development of another race of people who are energetic and who want to do something for their own welfare and benefit may put us all out of business, but I don't want to see that happen for the next 300 years, and I don't believe it will.
So our main task now is to keep strong, keep on developing, keep on expanding.
That's right, and keep the rest of the world doing the same thing.
Now, you spoke of our neighbor, rich neighbor to the north, with a parity of 105 now. There's some conflict as between that neighbor to the north for the first time and the neighbor to the south. Our biggest customer has become our biggest problem now.
Well, I don't think that amounts to anything. That's been a conversation ever since I can remember. And I think those people have common sense. We speak a common language. We can understand each other. And that's one of the difficulties around the world. There are so many different languages spoken in so many different places. And when you translate language from one, an agreement from one language to the other,